We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yo, yo, it's the top of the week. Get your popcorn ready podcast with your boy right here, T.O. and my homie Hatch.
Let's in the building.
Rolling. Yep, yep. We have a great guest today.
Anthony yes, sir.
Barr of the Six. Minnesota Vikings.
Six-year NFL veteran, four-time pro bowler at linebacker for the Minnesota Vikings, and overall good character kid. And he went to Loyola High School where we was working out last summer, T. I had you out there about to pass out when he was trying to run some raggedy slants.
Yeah, it's all right. That's all right. It's so funny. I'm running a lot of raggedy slants, but you be want me to come out there and run them, though.
Hey.
Exactly. I can run because your broke butt can't run them.
You got that right.
Your broken down body can't run nothing. You can't
but
run
I can watch, hit. Though.
Yee! You can't run a hit. But yeah, man, I'm looking forward to Anthony Barr. I honestly, like I said, even when I played and even post-football, I don't really know a whole lot of guys, but I definitely have heard this guy's name. A number of times, so I'm definitely looking forward to talking with this kid. I know he's done a lot of great things, as you said, your Loyola product. This guy, like I said, making his presence known on and off the field. So I'm looking forward to meeting the guy.
Absolutely, coming up on Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast, Anthony Barr from the Minnesota Vikings. Yeet! You can find us on the Himalaya app, wherever you get your podcasts.
And don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel, YouTube/Terrell Owens, and we'll have all this content available to you. So just subscribe to the YouTube channel, as well as any other social media channels. And like Tad said, subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
Sharing is caring. Holla at your boy. Anthony Barr coming up on Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast. It's all good. Welcome to Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast. We got a special guest today. Anthony Barr is in the house today. Appreciate you coming on, brother.
Yes, sir. No doubt. How we doing?
Oh, we good. We good. You know, we just trying to stay safe out here in this quarantine world. We got COVID going on. We got, you know, protesting going on. A lot going on in this world, but, you know, just trying to stay positive and keep it moving. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I feel you. I think we're all on the same page with that.
Yeah,
that's right.
So you out here in LA, right?
Yeah, I've been here for a while now, longer than longest duration I've been here since my college days. So it's been good, though. It's been good to be here, be with the fam, especially during these times, and everybody's been healthy and staying safe for the most part, you know, so I'm blessed.
What you been doing for like your workouts and stuff, trying to stay in shape for the season coming up?
Yeah, well, we was going to the gym pretty early on, like early March, and then COVID hit pretty hard right around then, like mid-March, and things started shutting down here. So I was on the at-home regimen for about a month. And then there's a little rehab facility I was going to that passes the medical, and there's a little gym in there. So get my weights in there. And then just the past 6-7 weeks, there's been a field down in Encino we've been going to, pairing that with the gym. So staying on top of it, you know, doing what we can during the times.
Nice. What would you say the tempo of your workouts are? Because everybody, like I said, you kind of think, well, is the season coming, not coming? Do I really have to get ready? Do I get in shape type? Or are you going 100 mile an hour right now?
No, I'm revving it up a little bit. You know, I'm an old dude now in the league, though, man. This is about to be my 7th year, you know. So I'm not going 100 miles per hour like I did, you know, back in the day. You know what I'm saying? I'm getting up there in age. So yeah. I ease into them. Start starting in March, you know, and then, you know, by this time we start picking up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you said your seventh year. How old are you, my man?
Yeah, I'm 28.
28? Oh, you ahead.
You're 28?
Y'all look the same. Y'all look the same. Y'all got...
It's been a while, dog.
Yeah, you know, I try to, you know, maintain, you know what I mean? It's, you know, it, I can grow it out if need be, but, you know, I'm have sure. a choice right now.
I'm sure. You know, I let the top down, let this thing kick back.
Let that good go. Let that good go. Yeah, well, shoot, being 28, one of the veterans in the locker room, how are you taking that? I said, getting the younger guys ready for the season that you got, talking to them on the phone, you guys doing Zooms, because you're not one of the leaders of the team now.
Yeah, it's been a different experience, obviously, this year. Not having OTAs, and I think that's going to hurt some of the younger cats, especially, you know, that's the time for them to get up to speed, kind of understand the culture in the locker room, meet your teammates and meet your coaches and see people face-to-face. So I haven't seen any of these young dudes. I haven't met any of them in person. You know, I've had the conversation that we had over the virtual meetings we have for about 7-8 weeks. But they seem like good people, you know, and that's a start. You know, I think that's kind of how we draft. You know, we draft kind of character guys first. You know, the athletic parts are obviously important, but we want good people in that locker room. And they seem like they're up to speed with it. You know, I have open line communication. Anybody, you know, they give everybody my number. Reach out if you want to chop it up, talk football, just talk life, man. I know there's a lot going on, so just trying to be an ear. I'm more of a listener than a talker anyway. So I think, you know, that kind of plays into my favor during this time.
Yep. Go ahead, T. You good?
Oh, yeah. So knowing that you're kind of the elder statesman in your locker room, you know, whether you want to be a leader or not, I think people are going to look up to you as such. You know, do you think, where does that leadership come from? Do you think, obviously, I think a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, you have had a number of relatives that have played at the professional level. Is that where some of your leadership has come from, having these guys that have been at the, you know, kind of forefront for you leading and going into the NFL?
Sure. No, I think, you know, a lot of my leadership comes from my mother and my grandfather. You know, I was raised by a single mom in my grandparents' house, you know, so I seen my grandfather work, you know, tireless hours at a young age. You know, I was my mom was a young mom. She was 19 when she had me. So I grew up kind of with her and some of my aunts and uncles in the house as well. That carries on to high school and to college. You know, I think I had a really good positional coach in college, Jeff Olbrich, who now like an assistant DC over in Atlanta. He played in the league for about 10 years in San Fran. I don't know if y'all crossed paths at all.
Jeff Olbrich, that name yes, rang sir. A bell when you – he thought he was a stud. he thought he was a stud, bro.
He goes hard, man. He got me right. He got my mental right in college in terms of, like, you know, what I need to do and how I need to get there. And he really, you know, helped me with that. But I think I've always just led by example, really. You know, like I said, I'm not really a rah-rah, getting-in-your-face type, but I'm going to go out there and do my job and do it the right way. And I carry that on off the field as well. You know, there's a certain way I like to live about my life. I'm a, you know, man of morals and principles. And, you know, I try to do things the right way for the most part. And, you know, I think that can be contagious. If you see it done the right way long enough, you're like, okay, this dude, obviously, he's been there for a while. He knows what he's doing. And it kind of gets everybody on that same page.
But yeah, I come down to, you know, the Vikings training camp pretty much every year. Of course, I see you down there. But, you know, it all starts with Coach Zimmerman. You know, again, like the character of you guys' team is like the character of, you know, pretty much your head coach. How important you think it is, character versus talent in the NFL? Because that's what we try to preach a lot on here. Because, again, I'm a small school guy. T's a small school guy. And, you know, people just think, oh, you're 5-star, you go to Alabama, you go straight to the league and play 10 years. It doesn't really work like that. It's got a lot to do with your character, work ethic, more than just your talent.
Yeah, I think talent's going to get you there. The character's going to keep you there. You know, I think talent, everybody's got, obviously, you have to have some type of talent to make it to the league, make it to college, even high school, right? Like, you got to be able to, you know, run fast, jump high, you know, lift weights at a high level, all that. That's a given, I think. I think everybody can agree on that. But in terms of remaining, you can get 2-3 years in the league pretty easily based off your talent. But you know, and then it comes to character, and you have to be faced with some tough decisions, you know, as you progress through the league. And there's going to be people asking you for all different types of things people ain't never heard of. You know, all of a sudden your cousin now, and you're gonna have drama with females and drama with all type of things, right? And you're gonna be pulling a whole bunch of different directions. But you gotta understand what got you here and why are you here. You know, you're here to work. You're here to play football. You have a job to do. So if you can keep that the main focus, and all the other cars and houses and jewelry and all that flashy stuff, like, that's all fun, man. That comes with the territory, and you earn it, you deserve it. Like, go do those things. But that's not gonna keep you in the league. Like, your choker, diamond choker, that's not gonna make plays for you, right? Like, you still gotta get out there on Sunday and perform. So it's good to look good, and I agree. I like to dress. I like nice things too. But I understand where the priorities are, and that's what my team, that's what my family, and I keep the main thing the main thing.
Yep. Speaking of talent, speed, and those things that, like, as you said, it gets you to the league, and obviously the character it kind of sustains you. But when you think about speed and talent. You played running back, wide receiver, tight end,
everything
at UCLA. So now you're a linebacker. You've been in the league what, seven years now. Talking about obviously sustaining and obviously talent getting you into the league. Do you think you would be still in the league if you would have stayed at one of those positions, running back, wide receiver, or tight end? And then give me the best position out of those three that you feel like you possess.
I think no. First of all, I don't think I'll make the league as a receiver or running back. I'm too big to be running back, and I'm not twitchy enough to be a receiver. I think I could pull off tight end though. I think I'm big enough. I'm fast enough. I could, I got a decent amount of decent hands. I could block. I guess if I had to, I don't really like blocking. But I think if I stuck with tight end, maybe I would have be able to pull it off. But outside linebacker, like 3-4, that was like in college, that was my thing, like being on the edge. Mm-hmm. And so I really changed position again when I got to the league, like going inside and being like, I'm still considered outside linebacker, but we're in the 4-3, and like we're playing nickel, 60-70% of the snaps. So I'm really inside there. So I'm low key, I feel like I've been playing out of position like for a while. I think my natural like best position on the field would be on the edge, like 80% of the snaps. That's just not the case. And I've been able to make a career out of this position that I'm in, and I've been fortunate to be this far, but I still think I'm kind of playing out of position even this far in my career, which kind of sounds like kind of crazy, but that's just how I feel about it. Mm-hmm.
So what sparked that transition though? I mean, to go from offense to defense, and then obviously you've been very, very successful on the defensive end. What gives you the idea, especially in college, because that's a big transition, especially your sophomore year going into your junior year. That's a big adjustment for any kid, for that matter. Then you're trying to obviously make it to the next level, at the pro level.
Yeah, I think it was a couple factors. First of all, we were terrible at UCLA my first 2 years, I wasn't playing much, so I was labeled a running back or H back or whatever you want to call it. But I wasn't really getting on the field that much. I wasn't producing. And there was a point where I was just like, man, this is not fun anymore. Like, I'm used to being, scoring touchdowns and being, have the ball in my hand and all these fun things. Like, it's kind of an addictive feeling, right? I'm sure T.O. can attest. Like, Matt, you could attest, like, catching your phone tugs. Like, that's
no, I
that's
can a feeling, attest. Right?
I can attest. He just had about 100 more touchdowns than me, but I can't attest.
But the feeling, like, it's an addictive feeling, like, and that's something I really wanted to, continue doing. But we had a coaching change my sophomore year. Coach Moore came in with his defensive staff. Olbrick was on that staff, right? And that was he was our linebacker coach. And one of my first days, I think it was in January when Coach Moore was on campus, I was thinking of transferring, like stop playing football, really, because I just wasn't having fun. Like, when you don't have fun with something, especially for me, like, I can't really force myself to do something I don't like. But then we had a conversation. He started talking about defense, and like, Coach Moore was so passionate at the time, and same with Olbrick. Like, they were just they just kind of reinstilled that love for me. That was kind of missing, like sparked it up again. And next thing fast forward to week one, we out there and I'm playing outside linebacker, flying around, making plays. I'm like, man, this is fun again. So it was a combination of like me, having that conversation, and then the coach was like making me feel good about, because they could easily say like, we don't want you to do that. And that would probably like shut me down again. But they were like really open to it, and they really accepted the idea. And that was like, that was everything I needed to hear.
Nice. So I know, like I said, last year I was coaching at Loyola High School, brought T up there. You know, he came up to a bunch of games, got to know a bunch of the kids as well. Yeah. But we also know, say, you went to Loyola High School. You are the legend. At Loyola High School, because they said you were the same size almost playing running back in high school. Like you were 6'2", 6'3", 230, 240. Right. So again, doing that in high school, you know, how that, of course you're a running back with the ball, but were you like a men amongst boys out there? Like go back to a little bit on your high school career.
High school. Honestly, I remember when I first got, like my freshman year, like Loyola, when I was growing up, was like a big football powerhouse. And that obviously has changed a lot since, since then. But, you know, when I was going to, there was, you know, they was one of the CIFs and they were sending people to college and sending people to the league. And like, so when I got there, I was like, man, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to make it. Like I was a young kid and I didn't know any better. And then you get there and you're like, oh man, this is, I've been doing this, you know, for four or five years. I could hang with these dudes, and that's how it was. Freshman year, you know, we were solid. Sophomore year, same, and you know, on through college, like I didn't play my whole senior year. Actually, I broke my ankle the second game of the year, so like I missed my whole senior season. But junior year, yeah, like I had like 20 touchdowns, like 2,000 rushing yards. And I guess I never felt like I was like a man amongst boys, but I just was confident in my abilities. Like I knew what I could do. I feel like. Nobody's gonna stop me. I was gonna get the rock, and I was gonna go and score. Like, and we had a good team. We had a really good team, but we just fell short. I think there's multiple factors and we're involved with that. But and it's kind of been that way for Loyola since. Like, we haven't really bounced back and become a program that is just like even respectable now. It's kind of like scoffed at, you know, when you mention them. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, they do things by the book there. You know, they're not out recruiting. They're not out getting guys from other schools, and prime schools. But, you know, at some point, you know, if you want to compete, you know, you got to work, you know, you got to not bend the rules, but you got to do something, right?
You got to do what everybody else is doing at least.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think it's getting to the point now where maybe they're realizing it and they're starting to be like, all right, now we got to change it up a bit. We could, you know, step away from the traditional. We need, you know, the 4.0 student, like, It's you know, if you want some ballers, you got to find them. They're not all going to be in the classroom.
Absolutely. Now you also have a foundation, right, that you do with Loyola High School. Explain that a little bit.
So the last 2 years we've had our foundation event there, and the foundation is the Raise the Bar Foundation. We support single parents in their pursuit of education while providing childcare if that's, you know, that's the thing that the parent needs. We started this in 2015, so this would be our sixth year, I guess, which is crazy. You know, things are flying by. Or no, this would be our fifth year, 15. And it's been cool, man. It's been really rewarding. You know, I think like 95% of the people we've given scholarship to have either graduated or still, you know, going strong in their academics. And we're based in Minnesota right now, in Los Angeles. California, I guess, and we're trying to expand that, obviously, but we're still in like the early stages. You know, we're still getting our feet on the ground. This year, the event's going to be a virtual event on the 11th of July. We're going to start publicizing that and try to start promoting that a little bit within the next week or two. So you'll be seeing on social media. You know, follow me on social media, Instagram or Twitter at Anthony Barr. Just look out for that. It's a good cause, and it's been helpful to a lot of people, and we've got a lot of good feedback. So we're gonna, you know, try to ride the momentum that we got with that.
Now, Gordon, well, we're definitely for sure. Pump that up. Hey, yeah, your camera's. I know it's your camera shaking a little bit. Do you want to it'll be a little comfortable? I don't know if you got it propped up or you're holding it or something. You want to put it in the best light.
I'm just holding it, bro. I'm just holding it. Yeah. I don't got professional setup over here. I'm an amateur with this stuff.
There you go.
I was just saying, if you wanted to just kind of, you know, we'll give you a minute if you wanted to prop it up on something, whatever, so you don't have to hold it for the whole time, you know what I mean? Yeah, take your time, bro. Yeah, we want you to feel comfortable, you know what I mean? I just see it's shaking a lot.
Okay, for sure.
No doubt.
Yeah, buddy. You can check us out on the Himalaya app or ever get your podcast. Get your podcast.
Get your popcorn ready with your boy T.O. and Hatch right here. We got
in
our
the
man,
building.
Yep. We got our man Anthony Barr, Vikings.
Four-time Pro Bowler from the Minnesota Vikings. Speaking of Minnesota, of course, right? We know that's ground zero right now for the George Floyd protests and all these things going on. We know you're at the, you know, at the forefront for the Vikings as well as really like the whole city. Kind of explain some of the things you've been doing to, you know, kind of help bring light into that situation.
So, you know, with the Vikings, we have a social justice committee that I'm a part of with about 10 other players. And so we've been trying to just think of ways that we can help not only the city, but kind of connect with law enforcement there and kids really in the city. And so I was there 3 weeks ago. And we met with multiple groups. The first group we met with was this group called All Square Reform Program. They were just explaining how hard it is for, you know, convicted felons and, you know, convicted crimes to kind of get back on their feet, you know, once they finish their time, they, you know, kind of pay their debt to society, whether that's a 5-year sentence or 5-month sentence, whatever. That kind of stigma is with you. And it's literally like on every job application, like, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Have you been convicted of a crime? Like, and usually, if you know, you have to say yes, you can't really lie about that. And you're not really getting that job if, you know, for the most part, if you know, that once they read that. So this program brings in those, you know, those ex felons into their building, and they send them on jobs and they get them jobs, and they have like a kitchen on site that put people to work in the kitchen. They're working on starting to build their media platform. So they have starting to do kind of podcasts like what y'all are doing. And just kind of getting people, you know, a second chance, because they're just really describing how hard it is for, like I said, for people to get back on their feet after they already felt like they've paid their due. And that kind of tied hand in hand with the JDC that we met with out there, which is the Juvenile Detention Center. A lot of these kids are, whether they're in for, you know, small things or major things, you know, they're still kids, you know, they're, you know, 17, 18, 19-year-olds who have been, you know, in this building for. And when we talked to them, they, you know, a lot of them had been there for a couple of years, months, you know, whatever the number was. But for the last 2 or 3 months that they were there during COVID, they haven't had no curriculum. You know, the teachers that had been laid off or furloughed. So they kind of just been sitting there playing games, watching movies. We were trying to stress the importance, not only to them, but to like kind of the people like that were taking care of. Like, man, you got to do something productive with these kids. They're kind of just wasting away. And so they made a mistake. Like, they have so much more life to live. And there's a lot more out there for them. So we're going to continue to open lines of communication with them, try to be more present. Myself, especially, I'm kind of putting the pressure on myself to stay consistent with that. And then finally met with the police department, the police chief of police, and like 3 officers. And we kind of just had an open Q&A with like a bunch of the players, about 10, 15 of us, and just shooting off shots and understanding, that's probably not a good thing to say, but shooting off any questions. Just asking them, you know, why this, why that, how did this happen? How does it lead to this? How can 3 officers stand by and watch another murder somebody? Like, what is the protocol? Are they supposed to step in? If I'm a civilian watching, can I step in? Like, what are some answers?
Yeah. Cause I don't even know. What are some of those answers?
So he was just like, during the training, like we're taught to intervene if excessive force is being used. And I was like, so how did nobody step in? And he's like, they were just wrong for, you know, not stepping in, not intervening. And they said, is it like a frat house type thing where like, oh, I don't want to mess with my boy while he's doing something. Or is it like a boys club type thing where like they're afraid to step on toes and hold each other accountable? Like, what's up with that? Like, if I'm a human being, like as myself, and I see something, whether that's a police officer or not, like I want to go intervene. Like I want to step in and help somebody. Right. But I asked, like, so if I'm a civilian and I'm seeing this, a police officer abusing somebody, can I go myself? Can I intervene? He's like, well, you know, legally, no. And that would probably escalate the issue, right?
Now I'm
you know, kind of involved in that.
Yeah.
But the other 3 officers just stand by. And he was like, well, that's not a reflection of everybody, which I get, but still, like, so it's just a coincidence that these 4 dudes happen to be working at the same time, on the same street with the same dude. Like, and so some of the questions were answered. Some of them I didn't feel, you know, very good about the answer. Some answer kind of felt were like kind of brushed to the side.
Of course.
But I think the pressure, they felt the pressure, like they, you know, it was applied. And so, but as far as I know right now, like Minnesota is trying to, Minneapolis is trying to disband the police department down there and replace it with, you know, community members. But personally, I think like the police are necessary, you know, like
absolutely,
of course, just good police officers are necessary.
Right, like 2-3 in the morning, like who you gonna, if somebody's breaking your house or, you know, something goes wrong, like who you usually gonna call? Like you call the police, right? Let's just, I don't know, people don't really feel confident in doing that right now. And that's unfortunate because these guys are supposed to, you know, protect and be the ones that we look up to. And my thing is like, how can you expect, like you're supposed to be the best, right? You're supposed to be the best of the best. People look up to you, like you're supposed to be protecting communities.
Right.
And if y'all are misbehaving, how do you expect the communities to behave? Like, how do you expect people looking at you to go ahead and like act like, you know, proper human beings when the leaders aren't doing that? So we're looking at y'all and y'all are giving us bad examples. So how do you, you know, how do you expect anything to get better if the leaders are kind of, you know, not doing their part?
Right. So you got drafted in Minnesota by Minnesota in 2014. So you've been in Minnesota for 6 years. You've seen it.
Yeah.
Now, was this like a shock when this whole thing came down with George Floyd? Or have you seen some red flags, or were you treated a certain type of way by any type of law enforcement during those 6 years?
No, there was. They've historically been known as one of the most, I don't know, if abusive or problematic departments in the country, not just like in Minnesota, but like Minneapolis Police Department has been pretty corrupt for a while, according to, you know, historical evidence. And, you know, even the chief, you know, our general manager asked a really good question. He said straight up, like, is there racism in your police department? And he was like, well, I mean, this department's over 100 years old. So, like, of course, you know, it's kind of rooted on that. And from the research I did, like, the police were first implemented to catch runaway slaves. Like, this is when, you know, police started. Mm. It was like the people trying to get freedom. These people were capturing these people and bringing them back. And these are usually, obviously, white people. So, yeah, I think the department is kind of rooted on racism. And, you know, you try to move away from that. And I think as time goes on, like, you start moving away from it, but it doesn't disappear, never like necessarily leaves. Right. In terms of experience, I had one teammate that I think he won his lawsuit. It was about 2 or 3 years back. He was at a restaurant, sitting outside the restaurant. I think he either just finished or was waiting to go in. And, you know, law enforcement approached him and said, hey, you can't be here. You can't be standing here. But he's like, no, I'm a customer. Like I'm not sure if he was coming or going. And they gave him a real hard time. So he took his phone out, started recording it. They slapped his phone out of his hand and like started getting aggressive with him. Luckily he had that, you know, on camera, he had witnesses there. And he was able to win his lawsuit. So, personally, for me, I have never experienced that in Minnesota. But I know my experience isn't the experience of anybody. I have the luxury of being an athlete in the city, which is, you know, that goes a long ways.
Absolutely.
With a lot of people in that. The common man, the common African, the common black man is not going to get that same respect that I get because I name drop my employer. You know what I'm saying? Like I have that, like I said, that luxury. So I know some teammates that I've had, you know, some tough experiences, but personally I haven't had that.
Yeah. Again, from Minnesota. So, and you also grew up in Los Angeles. So there's a lot of that in Los Angeles as well, but yeah, I didn't even know, like I said, the race going back 100 years in Minnesota and them, you know, like I said, chasing down slaves 100 years ago.
Well, that wasn't just in Minnesota.
That's how the police department was formed. Right. I'd be shocked. And yeah, like, of course, 100 years later, it's still going on because there's people in there that think.
It sounds like a long time, but bro, that's not that long ago. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, you think 100 years, that's 1920. Like, that's really not, we're not too far removed from that.
True. Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy.
This meeting that you guys had, you said it was a 10 to 15 of you guys going into that. I mean, what were your feelings going into that meeting? Because I know for me, I probably, like I said, there would be a lot of anxiety. I'm sure there would be a lot of probably anger or whatever. Obviously, there are some questions, obviously, you guys ask. And I'm, as you mentioned, obviously didn't get, you know, the answers that you wanted. But going into that, you know, understanding. Like now, we're probably maybe a little over a month after this death. Can you just give me a sense of the feeling in the room? Because I'm sure they probably had some anxiety, you know, meeting and talking and discussing with you guys, as I'm sure you guys were as well. What was kind of like the mood? Can you just kind of describe it for us?
I mean, for me, man, it was like it was kind of like going to a game. Like, I had to prepare for it. You know, I had to kind of do my studying up. I had to gather my information. And then when it was time to get, you know, the lights were on, it was time to, okay, fire some questions out and try to get, you know, try to have a productive conversation. And it wasn't like a motherfuck situation where I'm just, you know, grilling them and being like, blah, blah, this, that, and they're like, we had to have some dialogue and
conversation.
You know, it was founded on like a base of respect. Like, it wasn't, you know, we understood, like, okay, they're part of the force that were the cause of this murder, but these weren't the guys that did it. So it's not like our feelings of disdain and upset wasn't like pointed necessarily at those guys, but they had to be accountable for the rest of those people. Like, one of my players misses a tackle and the dude score, like, still counts against our points per game and against the whole defense. You know what I'm saying? So, like, one dude kind of maybe doesn't represent everybody, but everybody's going to feel those repercussions of, you know, somebody messing up. So it was I wasn't necessarily nervous or scared or like, but I was very, I guess a little anxious. Like, I was definitely interested to see how they were going to respond, how they're going to communicate with us. And I think for the most part, they were pretty transparent. Like I said, I didn't necessarily agree with everything, but that wasn't the point. Like, we weren't there to have it wasn't to disagree or to agree. It was more so to, just to educate, ourselves on kind of the training and the practices and the rules really of
and what can we do? Yeah, what do we do?
Yeah, like, how do we help? How do we, you know, what can we do to help the situation? Like, what do you need from us that you don't have that wouldn't make your job easier, you know? So
So Alex King or Alex King or whatever, he's one of the four officers that were holding George Floyd down. And I've done a little bit of research on him, and I've come to understand that part of, like, he had only been on force for like this particular group of guys. He had only been there from like about 3 or 4 days.
Right.
And so come to find out that he joined the police force because he's witnessed, you know, something like this, I think to a family member or somebody in his family. To police brutality. And part of his reasoning for joining the police force was to prevent the very thing that he was a part of.
Right.
Wow. So
yeah, that's
for
crazy,
me, exactly. So for me, like I said, it's kind of hard to kind of understand the very thing that he tried to join the force to prevent, and he becomes a part of.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to figure out. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just like with any, it's different until you get a position of power, right? Like, anytime, and it's all good, like, until you get like put in the heat of the moment, and now you're an enforcer. And I feel like historically, every leader, every like community leader, it doesn't matter if you're the best person on earth or like a bad person, people abuse that authority. You know, people like historically are gonna find a way to do it, whether they realize it or not. Like, you're gonna find a way to abuse that power. And I'm not saying that's what officers do, but I think they kind of get caught up in the moment. You know, they got the gun, they got the badge, they kind of feel like, you know, I'm a badass dude, blah, blah, blah. I'm here to protect and serve, but don't try me either. Don't question me. But that doesn't make you're not almighty when that situation, like, you can be wrong too. You can still learn. Like, you can still grow. Like, just because of your situation, like, that shouldn't force you into, and the other thing I was saying was like, non-compliance shouldn't equal death. Like, even
absolutely,
I understand, like, complying is the best way to prevent things, but even you see people that are complying, they're still getting tossed around and, you know, and beat up and shot and killed, right? So it's like, but like, even if I'm not complying, like, that shouldn't trigger, okay, he's not complying, I'm gonna kill him. Like, that doesn't make sense. How does that, the first thing you think of, like, there's got to be some steps in between there, a whole lot of steps in between there before that's the result to that.
Right. And I think that's kind of what I'm angry about. Like I said, it's like, because we can't handle it the right way. Whatever we do, if we say, what am I getting arrested for? We're being a smart ass. If we don't say nothing, oh, you one of those quiet. It's like, whatever we do, if that person, if that, you know, that one particular cop wants to be racist, wants to be an a-hole, wants to do, you know, that's his day of being that dude. then then we're going down. You know?
No, I agree. That's why it's kind of scary, bro, because you never know. And I shouldn't feel the type of way when I see the lights behind me. Like, I should there be like, go. Oh, this is cool, but that strikes fear. Like, my stomach goes, you know, my heart goes in my stomach, and I'm like, oh, shit. Like, I thought I just went on a roller coaster. You know, I don't feel great. Yeah. And, you know, and I know that's the feeling for many black males, man. I know that's got to be a feeling that y'all experience as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think with the guy, Alex King, he comes from a racially diverse family. He has a couple of sisters. His mom is white. His dad is from Nigeria. And I find it so interesting that his sister, if they haven't done it already, they're changing their last name not to be associated really? With him. And with the protests, again, they've been out protesting against him as well. And then that's I just crazy. Found out too that this guy, again, he's out on bond. He's out on bond as well. And he's running into some issues where, again, obviously, rightfully so, people have confronted him about this, that, and the other. So me personally, I don't even know how he would even have the guts to be out right. in public, you know, especially with everything that has transpired. So
I think people might not think they're racist, but I think society and just like the culture we live in, there's so many like movies or like shows, like the show Cops, like you've seen black people get arrested all the time on that show, predominantly, right? So like in your head as a young kid, like a young, whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian, like whatever, you're seeing black men get arrested all the time. So they're teaching you without teaching you that like, absolutely. Oh, these guys are bad. You know, like these guys are dangerous. So like that carries on through your life. As you get older, that's, you're going to have that feeling. You see someone like walk by you, you're going to lock your door. You're going to walk to the side of the street. When we're no different, man. We just look a little different. That's it. We're no different as people. We want the same things in life. We want to be happy, successful, have a family, all these things. But I think society teaches us and molds us from a young age, like how to treat certain type of people.
Mm-hmm. And that's an issue, especially with athletes. It's like we talked about this a couple weeks ago as well. Being an athlete, you're going to have a lot of people at your fingertips saying, I support you, I love you, you're my boy, you're the best. And then on their Twitter or on their Instagram or their Facebook, they're saying, you know, they're racist and, you know, black lives don't matter. Like, right. Which one is it? Like, you like me because I'm in this Minnesota Vikings uniform, but once right. I come out of this uniform, you're not supporting me or exactly. my culture or nothing I do. Exactly. And that's the issue.
Exactly. I want to read you guys something from one of his siblings about the situation when it all transpired. And this will give you a sense of where his sibling, you really kind of where she is. It says right here, it says, in a Facebook Live video, his sister, Taylor King, 21, appeared with the head of the local NAACP to speak of the injustice that befell Mr. Floyd, acknowledging being related to Mr. King, but never mentioning his name. Mr. King's sister, Radiance, posted a video of Mr. Floyd's final minutes on Facebook, and she said, "Just broke my heart," she wrote. In an interview, she said that as a black man, her brother should have intervened. She said she planned to change her last name in part because she did not want to be associated with her brother's actions. She says, quote, "I do not care if it was his third day at work or not," quote, mm-hmm. she said. "He knows right from wrong."
Yep. Yeah. And that's what we're saying. It's like, because to me, it's humanity. How do you treat another human like that? Yeah. You know, and like that's the going no, back to.
It don't make sense to me, man. Don't add up. Like.
No.
I don't know. That's why, you know, I think like with police officers, I think some of it is, you know, they deal with a lot of trauma. Like they see a lot of things, like just like war veterans, like they go, mm-hmm. and I'm not excusing anything they're doing, but like I think they need psychological practices in the department, like mandatory sessions where they can, whether they talk about it or not, like they need to have psych training. They need to have more than just the, you know, the department, the typical training they do, whatever they're doing, you know, and that needs to be ramped up. And I was also talking to my uncle about like, he's an officer, you know, defunding the police and first dismantling. And, you know, he was saying like the funding really, you know, in my understanding, it's more as just allocating the funds into other, you know, other areas instead of just, you know, going into one part of the department. You kind of open it up a little more. So now they have a little more resources for like social workers, like officers don't need to be responding to like social calls that social workers should be responding to, you know,
right.
A lot of like people that, whether they're like the drug problems, like drug addicts, the officers don't want to deal with those things. They're just going to pick them up, put them in the car and take them to the station. Like these people need help. Like these people need mental mm-hmm. help and you need social.
Right, the other facilities. Yeah. That's not an area for the police. Yeah.
Don't throw this dude in prison, you know, unless he's distributing and, you know, obviously that's different, but as users need help. They need people to help him pass his addiction. I think that's a whole nother issue. Like that's just, and then most people are black people like that in prison, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So with that being said, you know, trying to switch gears a little bit, obviously everything that we're dealing with now as a country, especially dealing with racism, you know, this was sparked by the kneeling, the protests of Colin Kaepernick, you know, and obviously it fell on deaf ears 4 years ago. What do you think about now? Obviously, you were part of this group of guys that rallied and put out this video, you know, that Black Lives Matter. And then, you know, can you kind of just give us a walkthrough of how that came about, you know, with you guys just kind of, you know, collaborating and putting out that message and banding and unifying together. And then give us your reaction to, you know, Roger Goodell's, I guess his post after you guys did.
Yeah. So Cap, I think he was, you know, obviously he had seen this coming for a while and he was really, I guess for lack of a better term, the scapegoat for the league. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted to use him as an example. You know, we're not going to tolerate this. And he's lost his career over it. And that's like the ultimate sacrifice somebody can make, you know, losing their livelihood, their well-being, their job, their occupation for the betterment of others. And he brought a lot of recognition and light. And a lot of people were saying, oh, he's disrespecting the flag and he's doing disrespecting the military. When he was very clear with his purpose as to what he was doing and what he was doing it for, but nobody wanted to hear it then. And people kept twisting it and using the different narrative to kind of fit their agenda. Like, okay, well, he's even the president, you know, tweeting out, like, I'm not watching football anymore. You know, they're
gonna right.
And so that's like, it's taken away from the point and the message. And so, I think you'll be seeing a lot of kneeling this year. If there's a football season, I think across all sports, you'll see a lot of that during national anthems being played. In terms of the video that we had made, Eric Kendricks and I wanted to, you know, make a statement kind of before that video came out, because the NFL was real quiet on the whole situation. You know, we're a league made of mostly black men in terms of not the front office, but the people on the field, the soldiers out there on the field, you know, mostly black guys. And to not have that support from, you know, the league that possesses so much power and people look up to him so heavily, like it's so influential. That was kind of disappointing. So we wanted to kind of push the envelope a little bit, which I think was a start. And then Mike Thomas reached out for us to all be part of this video that he was really the ringleader behind it, put everything together and got the guys to, you know, speak their piece and then put that together, which I think was pretty powerful. And then it definitely, you know, I think nudged the league again. You know, when you see, you know, I'm a defensive player, but the, you know, the big faces are quarterbacks, receivers, you know, offensive guys, you know, running backs. And so when you have a video full of, you know, Mike Thomas's and Odell's and Patrick Mahomes, that's going to start
catching the needle on the envelope,
attention, you know. So I think Adele responded maybe 24 hours after that. he was quick to put something out after that. Yeah. And whether it was to save face or whether it was because he really felt that way, for him to say what he said, I think it was a start. Like he had never said nothing about that before. You know, had never, you know, been that vocal about it. And I think he had no choice, and mm-hmm. and the players kind of put that pressure on him. And so it was good. It was good to hear. We actually had a phone call with him 2-3 weeks ago, me and Eric, just us two and him kind of talking about, you know, what are the next steps? What is the league actually going to do to, you talk good, right? But what are you actually trying to do? Mm-hmm. You mentioned, and I was really specific on diversifying front offices and, you know, general managing positions and head coaching jobs. And he said there are rules in place and there are certain things in place that, you know, mandate, you know, a minority coach to be, or a minority front office member to be hired. But it wasn't,
it's not being adhered to. It's not.
That's
being
what I'm saying. Like, these you're saying there's rules, but look at the numbers. Like, the numbers right. are saying
it doesn't reflect those doesn't things that up. He's mentioning that he and said that are mandated.
Right. But he's like, how do you force somebody to hire somebody? You know, that's a whole nother issue. Like, mm-hmm. you had, and there's plenty of colored people that are qualified for these jobs, like ex players that would love to be in these positions, right?
Absolutely.
But they're not given the chance, and that I think that goes down. Like, he can do so much, but that comes down to the owners, in my opinion. Like, the owners and the individual teams, like, they have to set a precedence. Somebody's going to have to step up and set a precedence to do that.
And speaking of, when you say somebody has to set a precedent, you just mentioned, Roger Goodell is he's part of that equation, but I don't think he's going to be the one to move that needle. When you say somebody, that's honestly me listening to you. That somebody is just what you said. The 70%+ of guys that make up the NFL, and that's you black players. You guys have to make that happen. Because if you're waiting for a Roger Goodell to do it, no, he's going to get on that phone call and give you the song and dance, the typical, these rules are in place, blah, 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 blah. He's just going to give you the run of the mill. Nothing's going to happen. It's going to be up to you guys, bro, to move that needle. And until that happens,
I guess the question is how. Like, what exactly is it? And exactly, you know. So it's like, what steps do we do? What can we do as players to make that happen? You know, because what do you sit out games until it changes? Like, is that reasonable? Is that logical? Like, are players going to do that though? People want their money. You know what I'm saying? So that's
right. But just as you said, just as Colin Kaepernick made a sacrifice, you guys, the people like yourself. You're a black guy. You're a black player. You are in a position of power. You have a voice. Just like you guys made a stance with your video and you said less than 24 hours, Roger Goodell came out with a statement. Trust me, that's exactly what's going to happen if the majority of you guys, the black players, and even some of these white guys that are standing aside with you guys that are saying that they're allies, they stand for Black Lives Matter. If they stand in unison with you guys and like, yo, we're not playing unless such and such happens, trust me, it's going to be 24 hours or less before dialogue starts to happen.
100%. So again, I don't think we're unified enough as a players association.
Right. Yeah, you know? That's what has to happen.
We had a vote on the CBA. We had like 800 guys not even vote on their own CBA. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you're not going to vote on your own CBA, I know y'all know not voting on policies
real issues,
and governing and stuff like that. So it's like, we're so divided as a players association, whether because people don't care, they're not interested, whatever the reason is, we're not strong enough. We're not unified. There's too many guys. I don't know. We're just not unified.
No, it's, honestly, it is. Honestly, I'm on the outside looking in, bro. But I feel for you guys, it's sad to know that some of these guys, like I said, you guys have so much power and so much leverage. And like I said, sometimes you have to foreshadow. You got to kind of see beyond. You got to be a visionary. You got to see beyond where you are right now. And again, just as you said, you guys got to be willing to sacrifice just a little bit to get justice, especially in a situation like this. 100%. Justice. And then even on top of that, even with you guys, like you said, the CBA, like what, 800 something guys didn't vote on it. When you talk about the contracts that you guys have that are not guaranteed, there's not so many players that are going to be fortunate to be Anthony Barr's, Odell Beckham Jr.'s, or the top high end, position.
But I try to explain that to a lot of the young cats on the team, like. This is a serious moment for y'all, because I'm on the back half of my career. Y'all are just starting. Like, y'all gonna be dealing with this for your whole career, and all they can see was the extra couple extra dollars that they're gonna make
pennies.
And I'm like, that's what I'm trying to explain to people, but they don't understand. Especially when you're a young dude, you haven't seen any money like that before. Those are big numbers to you. So the league will use that against the younger dudes, because they know that they're not really thinking in that mind space. And instead of giving us lifetime, healthcare, which would be, way more beneficial than $100,000 up front.
Right.
Guys don't see that. They're not worried about that, bro. They don't see that. It's hard to It's hard to get everybody on the same page. Yeah.
You're talking about 1,800 players. It's hard to get 1,800, let alone 500 on the same page.
Bro, it's not that hard. With technology, bro, it's not that hard. Everybody can group text. Bro, you
can talk about it, but to get that person to buy in, to change that person.
It was tough, T.O., bro. I'll tell you, we were doing this with our team. It was tough to get everybody on. I had a tough time connecting with dudes, like whether they didn't answer my call, they didn't text back. Whether they did text back and it was just like a very vague response. Like, it was just people had other things going on. They worried about other things, and it's like, this is your life though. This should be important to you. It should be up there for you. And I don't think they took it as serious as it was. And we're stuck with this deal that we got for the CBA for another 11 plus years.
Yeah, but I commend you for trying though. Like I say, as long as you keep doing your part, you keep leading. Like I said,
a couple good things came from the conversation with Goodell, and I think he was sincere on a couple fronts, especially with the importance of voting and registering, getting guys to register to vote. And that was like one of the main topics, because like I said, If guys aren't voting on their own CBA, which is affecting them on a very personal level, I know guys are not registered, and I know the guys aren't voting on larger policies and larger people in office. Right. And so it was a suggestion that, because every summer during training camp we have a mandated set of meetings, whether that meeting is for on how to behave in the workplace. We have a sexual assault meeting, sexual abuse meeting. We have, what else? Like the new rule meeting that's every year. It was like, why don't we have, it takes 30 minutes to an hour, have a mandatory meeting in which you teach guys how to register to vote and have them do it right there. It's very simple, very easy to do. You're not telling who to vote for, where to check the box, but just registering, exercise your right that we were not afforded for so long. It's a very important thing, but. And I think he got that, and I think that's going to start being implemented in the years to come, which I think will be very important. And hopefully the importance of that will lead to guys understanding the importance of voting on the CBA whenever that comes in 10 years.
Who's the player rep for your team?
This year it was Steven Weatherly, but he's no longer on the team. He's in Carolina now.
So I was just thinking about an idea, obviously, like you said, to obviously try to get everybody on the same page. Yeah. Obviously, like I said, this would be some, I guess, food for thought. Like, again, I think to try to at least get everybody on the same page to really address some of these issues as far as trying to, get everybody on the same page as far as understanding, what it takes to get what you want, especially you players of color. I think you should probably maybe just try the idea, just getting, contacting all the player reps. And just as you said, call sort of like a players only type of meeting, people that want to really make a change and really fight for what you guys want. Yeah. Have those meetings, like you said, 30, 40 minutes after practice or whatever, and then connect the dots from there.
The thing that hurt us was the CBA was supposed to be voted on in the offseason when guys aren't
at the facility. They moved it up.
Yeah. So you can't get everybody in the same place. And we didn't have OTA, so we couldn't get everybody in the same place at the same time. And you can get 20, 30 guys, but you still have the guys on the team that aren't part of that. And their vote matters and their vote counts. And I know, talking with our player rep, they were down in Florida meeting with all the other player reps of the team. So it was like 64 guys. And he said it was deliberations were crazy. Like, there were all types of, people were on both sides of the fence. And that was just 64 guys. Now you multiply that by, however many to get 20. To the 2,000 guys, it's like, we're at a disadvantage because if we would have been able to get all of our guys into our meeting room and sit down for, like you said, 20, 30, 40 minutes, whether that's just in one day or 2 days or a period of a week, you can really start getting the guys and educating these guys on what's going on and what they, what the CBA really means. But they're just hearing things, whether it's from their agent, and their agent's working for the league, right? So their agents,
that was my other thing too. Like,
and the media's pushing out. The media works for the league, so the media's pushing out. Oh, this is a great deal. Take it. And so they're reading all these things, but they're not really educating or reading the actual text that's involved in this. And that's where it gets lost. And it's an easy thing to do to just check yes or check no instead of just knowing why you're doing that.
Like I said, I think, hopefully if something else comes out of it, we don't have to sign, or it's signed, but we don't go through that 11 years of the way it is right now would be great. But again, we might be locked in that thing for 11 years, which is crazy because it's not a great deal in my personal
opinion. Well, I mean, personally, I don't think they're locked in. Just no different. Like I said, it's no different than a player's contract. You feel like you locked in. Like I said, Bar, you just signed a deal for X amount of years. The Vikings can cut you next week if they want to.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Right. So again, move on.
Right. Good. So yeah. I don't believe in that. Yeah, you guys signed a deal.
The mentality of the players, they think that they're locked in.
I mean, you're not necessarily locked in. You're only locked in because, like you said, you feel like they got you thinking you're locked in. Yeah. But you guys can move the needle.
Absolutely.
Change that. It can be revised if need be. All you guys got to do, like I said, get together. So I think, like I said, obviously, like I said, take that idea to some guys. Like I said, obviously, once the season starts, you guys are able to kind of get back in the same building and be able to have that, you know, that meeting with a bunch of the guys, you know, independently of any coaches or what have you, to address some of these issues. So like I said, this problem is not going anywhere, bro. And I think guys that really feel like, you know, Black Lives Matter, and this is, like I said, this is something that's at the forefront of this country that really means something to them. They will attend those meetings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right, and I'll definitely will. Like I said, continue to put the pressure on myself to keep that thing fluid and hopefully get guys on the same page at the very least. You know, whether you agree or disagree, as long as you understand, as long as you're educated about it, I don't care if you how you vote, but don't just vote off of popularity or what you read, like, or what you see the guys doing. You know, do it off of what you know.
Yeah. Do you think there's something more needed? Because as of right now, they said once the season starts, bro, it's expected. It's not going to be surprising to me to see a bunch of guys kneel and then the media is going to be all over it like it's some great thing. So for me, I'm like, what's going to be more than a kneel? Because again, Colin Kaepernick did that 4 years ago. Now you got all these coaches.
You're still having the same problem, though.
Right. Yeah. You got all these white coaches and players coming out of woodworks. Oh, yeah. Now I'm a kneel. Oh, yeah. I'm going to kneel now. But where was that bravado 4 years ago? Why you couldn't push that needle 4 years ago? So
I think guys were a little more scared. I think they were scared. They were nervous. You know what I'm saying? They were, I don't want to upset nobody. But at a certain point, you got to be like, nah, forget that. Like, I'm doing
right, exactly.
I'm doing the right thing, and I do what I know is right. And the consequences are cool. Like, as long as I know I did the right thing, like, I'm not worried about the consequences. So I think the kneeling is great because it brings attention to the issue and you could talk about it, but then there has to be action. And that's where our focus is, I think, with the Vikings. Like, we're actually trying to be proactive and be in the community and talk with these programs and try to mend these relationships and try to just educate ourselves on what's going on in the community. And so I think, I don't know, I'm sure other teams are doing it too, but I know, especially with our owners, like, we have really proactive owners and the Will family.
Yeah, the Will family.
They're very generous and they're very thoughtful and they're very they've been very helpful for us. You know, they're not trying to suppress our voice. They're trying to urge us to use our platform and continue speaking out and whatever we need. That they have multiple conversations with the owners and they're like, whatever y'all need, just please continue doing what you're doing. We're proud. We're going to continue to support it. And that, I'm not sure every team, you know, all the players can feel that way on whatever team they are. I'm not sure every owner's, you know, giving that support to their players.
Yeah, shout out to the Will family because they definitely, I said, support their players. And you're right. Out of 32 teams, I would say maybe 5 to 10 owners are like that. You know, you hear a lot of players like, I have never talked to the owner. Exactly. You know,
no, our guys are out there and they're in there with us and they're very active in the community. So I'm just blessed to be with this organization because they have been so proactive and vocal about. Everything that's been going on.
Cool. Well, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, Anthony Barr on Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast. Man, I appreciate you coming on, brother. Like I said, you know, it's you keep doing your thing. You keep leading. I commend you on everything you're doing. Just stay strong, stay healthy out there, man. We appreciate you.
All right, y'all. Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Y'all be
catch. Yeah, no doubt, man. Appreciate you coming on. And for everybody that's listening, definitely please don't forget to check out his foundation, Raise the Bar. Acts as a nonprofit to help out single parents get post-secondary education. So definitely want to, you know, commend you for all your philanthropic work as well as you know, the things that you're doing on the field.
Yes, sir. My man. Thanks y'all for having me.
All right, man. No doubt, boy.
Peace. All right, bro. Yo, I commend him on being a leader. on the team. Like that's a, it's hard. People don't understand how hard it is to just be a leader amongst other men. You know, people like, oh, you know, he gets older. It's like, no, it's like you still have 30-year-olds in that locker room, 35-year-olds in that locker room. Anthony Barr is 28, and he still, you know, commends the respect enough to lead, to be one of the leaders on that team. I don't think people understand, like, just because you're older, just because you signed a contract for big money, just because you've made a couple of Pro Bowls doesn't make you a leader in the locker room. And I think he showed, you know, showed us why he's one of those leaders on the team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a number of factors that goes into being a leader, really establishing a leadership in a locker room, especially amongst almost 75 guys. Yep. When you think about the responsibility and then the accountability of a guy, that factors into really kind of how your team operates. And so you got a lot of young guys, and there's a lot of older guys too, being put into that leadership role. You're going to have a lot of guys looking up to you. So definitely, I commend him again, what he's doing on the field and off the field, because that leadership, obviously, it permeates throughout whatever he's doing.
Absolutely. And that kind of takes us to our three and out segment. And the first one I want to talk about was, again, him saying how they draft guys with character, you know, for him to know that, to him to know what type of guys he has to, you know, Coach Zimmerman was a big on character as a head coach. And for him knowing what type of guys are coming into that community and into that organization, and him being a leader of those men, kind of speaks volumes of what he's installing in these kids when they do get into that organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think what really struck me is that he took it upon himself. Obviously, he was in the lion's den. Speaking of Minnesota, I mean, he's right there in the heart of where George Floyd literally took his last breath. Mm-hmm. And to be able to have, again, the mental, I guess, strength, willpower, even just to reach out to the Minnesota law enforcement, the police department, to ask some of those difficult questions. Yep. I think this was something that, I guess, he and some of his teammates, and I think even the organization, organized to where they needed some answers. They want to be able to make Minnesota a better community, because right now there's a big target on the state of Minnesota, the police department itself, and to obviously, like I said, to have a meeting with the chief of police, and then piggyback that also with the commissioner of the National Football League in Roger Goodell. So hopefully something became of those two meetings. But from what I heard, like I said, there was a lot of unanswered questions that were being asked in that room.
Right. Right. And thirdly, again, to piggyback off of that, is his conversations with the ownership of the Minnesota Vikings, right? Like I said, shout out to the Wolf family for really having the players back, because as you know, especially in this climate, how important it is for us to want to do something in our community, want to do something with our team. And then the owner's like, yo, I got your back. And for them to have multiple conversations, it's, you know, because as you know, I guarantee down in Dallas, those players are not having multiple conversations with Jerry Jones. And I guarantee there's a kid, you know, a couple players for sure that are trying to get a hold of him. And what does this mean? And what does it mean for my career? What's it mean for my community? What does it mean for my family? And when you can't get those questions answered, that's when frustration comes in. So again, the Wolf family having the players back, having all the Minnesota Vikings players backs in this, you know, climate speaks volumes, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I know they're one of maybe a couple or a few owners that have come out and spoken. And I think that's on every sports platform. When you think of, you know, Major League Basketball, the NBA, soccer, all these other organizations. But yeah, I think that's very admirable. Of those owners, and you speak of the Wills, to kind of echo, you know, really the sentiments of the players, what's going on in this country as far as, you know, Black Lives Matter, educating the ones that are, you know, that need educating on racism. And I think that efforts, you know, especially them going into their own pockets, not the organization's pocket,
not, you know, doing anything on behalf of the, I think that the Vikings organization, this is them personally being vested in what's going on in this country, I think is very admirable.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we appreciate Anthony Barr for coming on the show on Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast. Four-time Pro Bowler, six-year NFL veteran linebacker, Anthony Barr. Appreciate you, brother. So subscribe on the Himalaya app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel where you can see video, any other content associated with Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast. Go to youtube.com/Terrell Owens.
Yee! Peace!
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.